Good afternoon. The time is 3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon for Tuesday, August 17th. My name is Martha Moore. On today's program, we'll find out about community emergency response training with guest Jeremy Johnson. We'll talk to writer-photographer Larry Johansson about his ebook on the Alexander Archipelago. Aaron Elmore from Theater in the Rough will be here to highlight their upcoming season, and we'll learn about the elementary art program with teachers Nancy Leonard and Davin Savico. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The forecast today is calling for showers, highs around 55. Tonight, showers likely, lows around 47. Tomorrow, scattered showers.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian cabinet ministers have been heading to the country's west coast to promote pipeline projects in British Columbia. They've been directed to do so by Prime Minister Stephen Harper. This after pipeline negotiations with First Nations appear to have stalled. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Meetings are planned in the weeks ahead with First Nations groups as the Canadian government takes the lead on the pipeline debate. It's a major push to deal with opponents of the plan to build a pipeline from Alberta to the British Columbia coast, where Canadian oil could then be sold to lucrative Asian markets overseas. The initiative comes after the Prime Minister's special representative in BC said that talks with First Nations on the proposed pipeline are in tatters. First Nations leaders in the province say they will meet with a delegation of deputy ministers in about a week. Stuart Phillip is the Grand Chief of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs.
I have a sinking feeling that perhaps they're covering their backsides in terms of a consultation record, laying the groundwork that will be necessary when the decision is finally made by Prime Minister Harper and the Cabinet, regardless of what the Joint Review Panel comes forward with.
For First Nations, there is much at stake. They fear the Harper government will push through pipeline proposals no matter what. Phillip says he has no idea what Ottawa is now prepared to offer, but there appears to be some urgency. Stephen Harper has a vision of Canada becoming an energy superpower, but much of the country's vast oil deposits are in Alberta, and he needs to build pipelines to get that oil to market. Unless he can offer a more conciliatory tone in dealing with pipeline opponents, his vision will remain nothing more than a pipe dream. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
U.S. attorneys are focusing on criminal justice issues in Indian Country. As KWSO's Will Robbins reports, members of the Native American Issues Subcommittee are meeting with tribal leaders this week in the Pacific Northwest.
Tribal leaders from Oregon, Washington, and Idaho are meeting with leaders from the federal government at historic sites along the Columbia River to discuss a wide range of issues from treaty rights to strengthening tribal sovereignty through the implementation of the Tribal Law and Order Act and Violence Against Women Act. U.S. Attorney for the Oregon District, Amanda Marshall, says the gathering is a unique and meaningful opportunity for federal officials and Northwest tribal leaders to engage with each other on a number of critical topics.
This is another indication of the focus and determination of the Attorney General to make sure that we have strong collaborative relationships with our tribal leaders in Indian Country so that we can work better and continue to do the good work we are doing around enhancing public safety across the board in Indian Country.
Marshall notes that it's especially fitting that these important discussions are taking place where Native settlements and trading villages existed in various forms for thousands of years. The meetings conclude Thursday in Hood River, Oregon. I'm Will Robbins for National Native News.
Healthy Alaskans 2020, a joint effort between the state's Health and Social Services Department and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, have released a list of 25 health priorities. The health indicators include reducing the rates of cancer, suicide, and interpersonal violence and sexual assault. Disease control, lowering obesity rates, and curtailing substance abuse are also priorities. Goals have been set, and officials say the next step will be to initiate efforts to reach the goals. The Hood Museum of Art at Dartmouth College has received a grant to digitize its collection of Native American art. According to the Associated Press, the award from the Institute of Museum and Library Services will be used to photograph more than 3,500 items. Images and information will be posted online and feature a searchable database. Today we remember Pueblo historian Dr. Joe Sando from Jemez Pueblo. He passed away in September 2011. Sando was a noted scholar and author of several books. He was a consultant and lecturer with a rich knowledge of New Mexico's 19 pueblos. He died of natural causes at 88 years old. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you are tuned to Juno Afternoon on KTOO, and I have Jeremy Johnson here in the studio to talk about community emergency response team training. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Martha.
So let's just dive right in. What are community emergency response teams?
The Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT, is the group of volunteers in the community that are aware of basically how to attend to themselves and their neighbors in the case of an emergency. For instance, my favorite example is still the earthquake example, because that has so many cataclysms that come with it. So for instance, if there is an earthquake, the idea is that the CERT members, which is myself, will address the immediate surroundings before the real emergency service people show up. So, you know, I'm not going into a burning building. I'm not going, you know, to cross a broken bridge, but I'm going to help try and coordinate the local community and maybe triage what I can right there on the spot. It's minor, relatively minor.
So what other kind of emergencies do they respond to? And I guess specifically, what's likely in Juneau?
Well, first I should tell you that we are not currently at the call-out level. We're still at the organizational level. We've been going probably for 18 months or so this time around. This is the third time that the CERT endeavor has happened. And so far there's not been a call out. However, that's on the very immediate horizon as we continue to work with the local formal emergency response teams, you know, like the police and the fire department and the emergency and Bartlett, I mean to say, you know, those sorts of groups. But if I may have you repeat the question.
Oh, well, what other kinds of emergencies besides earthquake do you envision?
Well, you know, any circumstance where there may be something that is sort of tangential to the actual emergency at hand. For instance, the downtown fire, we had to call in other external emergency resources, we being the city, not we being CERT. And so we brought in these external people, but still there was room for more help for more trivial matters like keeping people at bay. You know, we needed to have a sincere perimeter away from the fire so no one really got basically extra hurt. You know, we didn't want any incidental damage to anybody to happen. That's the kind of real actual scenario that I could see. That sort of thing. Because, you know, if it had spread to further buildings, we would have had to have helped perhaps in evacuating non-burning buildings and things of that nature. You know, I think of it like community members who just want to help out, you know, and don't want to step on feet.
And want to know what they're doing while they're helping
exactly,
out.
Exactly, exactly.
I can see that's important. So do you have any funding or sponsors, or is this totally volunteer?
Well, the people are all volunteers, but we operate under the Local Emergency Planning Committee, the LEPC. And that is run by Tom Matisse with Michelle Brown of the CBJ, City and Borough. And there is a monthly meeting for that organization, the LEPC, which is at Bartlett Hospital on the second Wednesday from noon to 1. And then there is our group, which are the citizens that are an extension of only that single office. you see. Mm-hmm. So the LEPC is a group of all of the, what I consider, big players in town. Basically, it's like the police are there, the fire department, Bartlett Hospital. You've got NOAA, you know, communications. You know, we've got people from the community that just happen to be there, you know. I'm trying to think of the disabilities folks. You know, I think there's a representative of JAMI that comes regularly, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're the other citizens, the extra citizens who are like, hey, you know, we're pretty bright. We could help out. What do you guys want to see us doing? You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the training.
Well, the training is very interesting, honestly. The first session is pretty much an introduction to the whole premise of a local emergency response. And then the second one is kind of the favorite, where most people get to do some activity. We used to suppress a fire. So we get to go out and we do it at the fire training center. Everything's done at the fire training center, the Hegvik center down by the DMV. And so we suppress a fire. We have maybe 30 or 40 or as many actually extinguishers as we need, and we go through extinguishers in groups of two, and we're trained how to suppress a small fire. Say, you know, maybe somebody's gone through their whole life and never had a kitchen fire or never had a car fire, and they're very, very lucky, but in the circumstance that they would like to know just exactly what it's going to feel like, you know, that's what the second class is for. The third one is disaster medical operations. You know, that's where when we're going to go around and we may find someone who is sincerely injured that we can still at least take to a safer place. Or in our circumstance, we're trained how to address minor wounds. You would think maybe someone's bleeding actively, you know, you put pressure on it. We're trained how to tie a triangular bandage and keep things in place basically until more certified people can come by and really address the wound. And then we classify each person. That's the main element that we're really doing, is just organizing and classifying. So that way, when the EMTs show up and then the fire response shows up, whomever is able to show up, they can as quickly as possible address those people and then get back to the emergency, because the whole time it's supposed to be kind of a frantic situation. Then we do light search and rescue, like, say, the example of the earthquake. If a building is stable, it looks good, but maybe a tree fell on it in an awkward way, and we're like, okay, well, there's no more structural damage. We could probably go in here. You go in, maybe get people that are disoriented. Maybe somebody's had some debris fall on them, and they just can't tell which way to get out. You know, shock does a lot to a person. And then the seventh session is about this. It says terrorism and psychology. I don't really think of that as the direct terrorism way. We treat it more like the disaster psychology, like someone who may have be suffering mental shock instead of a physical shock. Therefore, they're unable to deal with the situation or how to attend to your teammates who maybe are a little stressed out. You know, that kind of psychology. That's the way I think of it, though it is quite more in depth. And then the second most favorite thing is the disaster exercise. That's where we kind of do a mock sort of thing. We put dummies out with a little bit of wound or some kind. We put like little tags on them. And if we have people, we have the people enact as though they're wounded. And so that's fun, because usually we get existing CERT members to come and be wounded.
So when are these trainings taking place?
It's 4 Tuesdays and 2 Saturdays, and we try and put them all in a month, but this time we had to spread to November 2nd, so we're going from October 1st. We're giving people a little bit of notice here, you know. The posters are around town, you may see them, but October 1st through November 2nd, and specifically, that's October 1st, 8th, and 12th, October 15th, 22nd, and November 2nd. That's Tuesday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Tuesday, Saturday. We thought that would be a little easier to digest. Mm-hmm.
You know? And so how long does a class
last? Each session is about 2 or 3 hours, except for the Saturday sessions. They usually go about 4 hours. And then we have a ceremony downtown at the chamber on, I think it's November 6th. There it is. Wednesday, November 6th from 6 to 8. So that way, basically, after everybody gets off work, we come downtown and celebrate the success of the completion. And then I make sure I've got everybody's contact info.
So is the person expected to attend all of these trainings?
No, you can come in for spot trainings. But, you know, like I say, the fire suppression set is pretty fun. But when a person comes in and gets only a single set, I record that so that way if they want to come, that it's semi-annual, twice a year. So the next time round, if you want to catch the other ones, we'll fill you in. And then later on, which I'm going to say in less than 12 months, we'll have a protocol for calling out, and then we'll have a protocol. I'm not saying that we will have been called out, but that we'll have a protocol in place for getting background checks for our active CERT members. You know, search and rescue, we don't want people to feel at risk, so we want everyone to know that if a CERT member is coming, then they have been at least background checked and that sort of thing, you know. And that way, if you've missed those sessions, you catch them all up. And we say that once you're a CERT member, you're certified for 3 years. So once every 3 years, if you fill in the gaps or take a whole set, we just start over your certification for that 3-year period again.
Oh, great. Yeah. So how does a person sign up for this?
It's pretty easy. You can get in touch with Mike Lopez at Bartlett. His email address is MLOPEZ@BartlettHospital.org. And if you want to give him a call, it's 796-8989. He's the primary training coordinator. And I'm the administrative coordinator. Basically, I'm the volunteer coordinator, and I give people my personal email address, and that's jubael@gmail.com, and that's my personal email address. So,
okay, great. And how many CERT volunteers should Juno have? Do you ideally?
You know, should is a hard number to say. I mean, if I tell you my realistic goal, I feel like if I can get 1% of the population, then that's like 300 people. That would be really great. My goal, that's my long-term goal. My short-term goal is that I would like to see 40 active members by the end of next year. And right now, I'm going to say that we have around 20 active members. You know, the activity at the meetings is between 4 and 8, and it shuffles between people. And I'm looking forward to the time when the classroom that we use is full, because that will mean that we are working well together and coordinating our community efforts.
Okay, great. I've been talking with Jeremy Johnson about community emergency response team training, and it sounds like a wonderful thing to get involved with, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for your volunteer service.
No problem.
Okay.
They say don't change the old for the new, but I've found out that this will never do. Today. the change in the sea. And from now on there'll be a change in me. My walk will be different, my talk and my name. Nothing about me's gonna be the same. I'm gonna change my long tall to a little short fat. I'll even change the number where I'm living at. Cause nobody loves you when you're old and gray. There'll be some changes made today. There'll be some changes made.
And that was Hot Club of Cowtown, and they will be here Sunday night. And they're a terrific group, so you should plan on going. And you're tuned to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. And in the studio with me, I have Larry Johansson. Larry has authored a book entitled The Alexander 18, The Story of 18 Wilderness Areas in Alaska. And just this month in Alaska Magazine is an article by him called A Sea of Wilderness, Exploring Southeast Magnificent Alexander Archipelago. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. What is an archipelago?
Good question. An archipelago is where we're actually living. And a lot of people ask that, especially kids. It's a collection of islands. And we happen to live in a collection of islands. Well, not literally Juneau, but we're surrounded by a collection of islands. And the archipelago is different than what most people characterize as the Tongass, which includes a 19th wilderness area, which is the Russell Fjords. And so my book is about the 18 that are inside of the archipelago. And any sailor will tell you that Yakutat is not in the archipelago. So it's the Alexander 18.
And this is the Alexander Archipelago. And what's special and unique about this area?
Well, I had wanted to call attention to these wonderful wilderness areas. And the reason why I refer to it as the Alexander Archipelago or the Alexander 18 was to differentiate it between Tongass. I think so many things are labeled Tongass that I didn't want it to be lost in a sea of Tongass, so I named it the Alexander 18 just for that purpose.
And to emphasize that there are 18 different wildernesses, not just one big Tongass thing.
Correct. A lot of people think, well, are we in a wilderness? Isn't all of Southeast Alaska a wilderness area? But wilderness is a special political designation all of its own. It's different than a park. There's Glacier Bay National Park. A wilderness area is a designation of protection that is the most inclusive of protection of any land designation that has been declared. And it happened in the year 1964. The definition of wilderness was, and the designation was defined in that act, 1964, and that is the occasion of the book, is that next year will be the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. And the book explores the ramifications of the act and its progression and evolution over the last 50 years. And I think no place has that story been more illustrious than it has been here in Alaska. And I've had the fortune of growing up in Ketchikan in the 1970s and in the 80s, and that was a tumultuous time in the development of the Wilderness Act. And many people remember the land designation, the Alaska lands, and the discovery of oil and the debate over the Alaskan lands, including the data selections, were all happening in the 1970s, and I happened to have attended some of the meetings myself and actually was a participant in the original debate about the selection of the wilderness areas that exist today, and those all came about in the 1970s, 1979, and in the 80s. But Misty Fjords, Admiralty Island, Tracy Arm, just to name a few of the wilderness areas, were all created during that time. And since then, much of our understanding of what was proposed to have happened, what actually happened, are two different things. And the book is looks at it from a perspective of what was anticipated that the Wilderness Act would do and what actually has happened. And I've visited all 18 of the all 18 of the areas, and talked to the people who lived in the areas, and also the land managers who were responsible for the work for the Forest Service for dealing with the issues that the wilderness areas are faced with today, and got a pretty good picture and understanding of where, a snapshot, so to speak, of where the Wilderness Act is. And it's timely now, I think, to discuss the future of these wilderness areas and maybe what happens next with the Wilderness Act, and try to rekindle some of the passion that people had when they first created this act in 1964, look at it again and possibly reignite that passion in the youth for today that would hopefully find that the values that people saw in the Wilderness Act are still valuable today.
So do you feel like the intent and what actually happened is diverse somewhere in history?
Oh, I think from different people's perspectives, there was a lot of fear in the 1970s about the Wilderness Act. And what people saw, especially in Ketchikan, it was a fear that the land was being locked up, that it was being taken off the table for resource development. And a real fear for the jobs and the economy. And I think probably one of the themes that I discovered, and especially in Misty Fjords, was that it actually the opposite turned around. The argument, it became an economic boom. And even today, you can go down to the docks and you see the full planes lined up and the triple tall line up to take people who are paying top dollar to go down and see Misty Fjords. So nobody anticipated that as being the result of creating the wilderness areas. But even that in itself brought about new issues that land managers had to deal with. And one of them was maintaining the qualities of wilderness, the defined wilderness. And obviously one of those is people, and they call them encounters, the number of people you see. So the book talks about the issues that have evolved over the years, and that is one of the issues that is definitely a big one in the management of wilderness areas.
I read your article. It's a wonderful description and history of the Alexander Archipelago.
Thank you.
Of course, the photographs are really wonderful as well. And I think what impressed me is you make the point that you can never turn an area back into a wilderness, and you can never go back, which is sort of a big responsibility.
Yeah, I think that's something that that I've seen. Alaska has quite a reputation, and everybody knows once you've lost your reputation, it's hard to get it back, and it's a valuable reputation. You talk to people who want to come to Alaska, and they envision in their mind's eye a place still as wild as one could imagine a place yet, and I think that's a valuable commodity, and wilderness in Alaska is much different than a wilderness in the lower 48. And I think I make that one of the things I wanted to do in writing the book was to call attention to these 18 wonderful areas. they each have their own personality. They each have their own special qualities, and they're unique. And I think as years go by, in the next 50 years, when they're looking at celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, these areas will become much better known, and people will appreciate them for the characteristics that they have. And one thing I discovered is that not very many people have been to these 18, and to this day, I've not met anybody else who's been to all 18 of these areas. And I've done presentations in Ketchikan and to the Forest Service, and so if anybody's out there listening, I'd love to meet you if you have been to the 18 and get your impressions. But it just goes to show the uniqueness of these wilderness areas, the difficulty of getting to them, and the fact that their story is untold.
And how did you travel through these wildernesses? It must not have been an easy feat.
No, in fact, none of them are accessible by road. It was either by boat or by airplane for all of these areas to get to. I had worked previously for a small ship company that, in my responsibilities, were developing itineraries for small ships. So that got me to about half of them through the course of my work. And then when the small ship line went under a few years ago, I decided that I was close enough to getting to all of them that I would spend that first summer that I had off, not working for the cruise line, traveling around to these different places. And so I made arrangements for boat, for airplane, and kayak. Some of them I reached by kayak. And photographed them. And it was adventurous. There were many places and times when the ride wasn't as easy or as predictable as one might think. Just remembering a few crazy flights into some... I got some good stories if you got a longer program. You'll have to read the book, I guess. I talk about some of them in the book.
So there's most of the people will never see a wilderness, you know, these wilderness areas.
Right.
But why do you think it's important for them to just exist?
Well, I really think that in people's imagination, that it's important that they know that there's someplace out there that is still wild enough that it doesn't have a name. There's a picture that I took of a valley that's just absolutely gorgeous. It's one that's in Tracy Arm. It's a side valley that I've gone by several times, and I looked at the charts and it's unnamed. It doesn't have a name, and I think the fact that it hasn't garnered enough attention that somebody has bothered to name it is important in itself, and that it's nameless. It's kind of like the unknown soldier. It's got a deeper message. The fact that it's unnamed, and I think people really need to latch onto the idea that there's places that are yet unnamed. It's almost like a hope for the future, and that there's not every avenue, not every corner has been turned, not every route has been run, that there's still places in the world you can go to where you can come upon an unnamed valley. And I think that's important with and the book tries to emphasize that fact, too.
I'm speaking with Larry Johansson about his article, A Sea of Wilderness, Exploring Southeast Magnificent Alexander Archipelago, and his book, The Alexander 18. And the book is an e-book as well.
Yeah, you can actually download it on iTunes, which I thought was pretty cool. I wrote two versions of the book, and the one on iTunes is... it's written where you can tap the pictures and they pop out, so it's pretty slick. But if you're old-fashioned and like to hold the book in your hands, they're also available. Hardbound copies are available in any Rainforest bookstore in Southeast Alaska.
These works explore the 18 wilderness areas of the Alexander Archipelago, and including some history, description of the diversity, and interviews with people as well.
Yes, I think a goal in writing it was to identify the themes that run throughout all the wilderness areas, but then choose one wilderness area that best exemplified that theme and kind of run with it to illustrate the issues that face the wilderness today. So there's, Stikine River is a transportation corridor, and not only for people, but for animals as well. So we'll talk about the wilderness area and what's the difference between a migrating species and an invasive species. Believe it or not, there are snakes coming down the Stikine River. So are they invasive or are they migratory? But it's an example of one of the issues that wilderness managers are facing. Misty Fjords was the balance between visitors and remaining the sense of solitude. But there's a number of issues. I think by the time you finish the book, hopefully you'll have a good grasp of how the issues that face the land managers in wilderness areas today, and also a good grasp of the characteristics, because I found that each one of these 18 areas has its own personality and is actually very distinct. You wouldn't think that in a rainforest. You look out and everything seems homogeneous, but it's not. It really isn't. And one of the areas that the last one I went to was a resounding illustration of that was the Endicott River, which is just south of Haines and between Glacier Bay and Lynn Canal. I popped into there. I could have been on the east coast in Maine with the colored leaves and the deciduous trees and obviously lack of precipitation. It seemed like we had dropped down in the middle of interior Alaska, and it was really quite a shock to find such a diverse and separate microcosm of an environment in the middle of Southeast Alaska. But just to give you an example of some of the dichotomy that exists within the wilderness areas.
So I'm speaking with Larry Johansson, and it's a really beautiful book that he's put out, and in a very nice article in this month's Alaska Magazine. I certainly recommend it. Thanks for coming in, Larry.
Thanks for having me.
Support for programming on the station is provided by Kate Troll, candidate for Assembly area-wide seat, paid for by Kate Troll for Assembly, Box 240128, Douglas, Bruce Patello and Marlene Johnson co-chairs. Information at katetrollforassembly.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of September, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet who wrote "So Much Depends Upon a Red Wheelbarrow Glazed with Rain Water Beside the White Chickens." William Carlos Williams, born Rutherford, New Jersey, 1883. Father was a businessman, English, mother Puerto Rican. His mother spoke and read to him in Spanish. He went off to school in Switzerland, France, learned French, but came back, went to medical school, and practiced medicine full-time there in Rutherford, New Jersey. Williams said, "I have never felt that medicine interfered with me, but rather that it was my very food and drink, the very thing which made it possible for me to write. Was I not interested in man? There the thing was. Right in front of me. I could touch it, smell it. It was myself, naked, just as it was, without a lie telling itself to me in its own terms." It's the birthday of Hank Williams, Mount Olive, Alabama, 1923. Radio star, successful country recording artist, but he kept playing roadhouses, and he died on his way to playing one in Canton, Ohio. Died in Oak Hill, West Virginia, in the back seat of his Cadillac. He was 29 years old. It's the birthday of Ken Kesey, born in La Junta, Colorado, 1935. grew up in Oregon, on the Oregon River, went to Stanford University, studied creative writing. He was a night attendant in the mental ward of the Veterans Hospital, and his experience became the basis for his first novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It came out in 1962, was made into a movie in 1975. And it was on this day, 1787, the U.S. Constitution was signed by delegates at the final meeting of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. The Articles of Confederation, which had bound the colonies together, did not work. It was a loose confederation which emphasized the rights of states, and not a single state was paying all of its federal taxes. The government had no way to penalize them, troops were deserting, the military was weak. And so they wrote a constitution which called for a strong central government. Led by James Madison, who came every single day, took notes on the proceedings, argued tirelessly for the idea of the central government, and came to be known as the father of the Constitution. Here's a poem for today by Tom Hennen, From a Country Overlooked. There are no creatures you cannot love. A frog calling at God from the moon-filled ditch as you stand on the country road in the June night. The sound is enough to make the stars weep with happiness. In the morning, the landscape green is lifted off the ground by the scent of grass. The day is carried across its hours without any effort by the shining insects that are living their secret lives. The space between the prairie horizons makes us ache with its beauty. Cottonwood leaves click in an ancient tongue to the farthest cold dark in the universe. The cottonwood also talks to you of breeze and speckled sunlight. You are at home in these great empty places, along with red-winged blackbirds and sloughs. You are comfortable in this spot, so full of grace and being that it sparkles like jewels spilled on water. Tom Hennen's poem, From a Country Overlooked, from his collection Darkness Sticks to Everything, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lending Tree, where you can fill out one form and receive up to 5 loan offers at trylendingtree.com, NMLS 1136. Produced by Joy Biles with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And you are tuned to KTOO, and this is Juno Afternoon. I have in the studio with me Aaron Elmore, the director and the founder and co-artistic director of the Theater in the Rough.
That's right.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
So tell us about the Theater in the Rough just a little bit.
Well, our season this year is coming. We'll be opening our first show in November, November 1st. And the first show of the season is The Ladies of the Camellias. And the second show of the season is The Rivals. We're not doing any Shakespeare this year, although we have done quite a bit of Shakespeare in the past. We had our hooks into a production of The Winter's Tale for a little while, but then we decided that our ideas for the production were getting out of hand, and we wanted to have more time set aside to get that together. So we're doing Ladies of the Camellias is our first play. It's something that Katie and I have had sort of on the back burner for very nearly 20 years, actually. We saw a production of this at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland many years ago. And it is essentially the story of two divas and a Russian anarchist trapped in a theater in Paris in 1897. So hijinks ensue. The basic thing that draws these two ladies of the Camellias together is their love of a particular role, the Lady of the Camellias, which was a play originally written by Alexandre Dumas, and it is the story of that particular play is the same story that's the basis for the opera La Traviata, which is something else being produced this year. I see a poster just up here for the lyric, putting that on, which is tremendously exciting to have all this Dumas going on. Of course, the high school is putting on Three Musketeers as well. The story of the Lady of the Camellias is a very dreadfully sad woman. She is a courtesan who contracts consumption and dies by the end of it horribly. Of course, in the opera, she sings beautifully probably for an hour and a half before she actually manages that. The play ran for many, many years prior to being turned into an opera and was very famous. And the two actresses who perhaps made it most famous were Sarah Bernhardt from France and Eleonora Duse from Italy. Now, both of these women were world-class stars in their day. Amazing forces in the not just in the theater world, but just in everyone's lives. Everyone knew who they were, knew what they were doing, were interested in them. They were, in many ways, you might say, the first celebrities of the world. They had international fame before radio and television. So this is just print. It's just them touring the world, literally. Sarah Bernhardt went to Africa. She went to even far-flung lands like America and played before packed houses. Now, these two women, of course, were also competitors. And this role, the Lady of the Camellias, is one of their favorites. And they would do it whenever they sort of had to fall back on something. They knew they could get people to show up. Whenever the coffers were running low, they'd probably trot this one back out again. There is some historical facts that lead us to this meeting of these two great theater divas. But the play itself is essentially a sort of a fantasia, a divertissement on the whole idea of what would happen if one evening or one day these two women were drawn together. Now, the historical fact is that at one point, Sarah Bernhardt in her Théâtre de la Renaissance invited Duse to come and perform because there was no other theater available. And what this play is putting forward is that Duse decides to debut in Paris with her portrayal of Marguerite Gautier, the Lady of the Camellias, and Sarah Bernhardt decides she's going to do it the very next night. Obviously, the competition available for this would be critical gold, but in the midst of their meeting, according to this particular fantasia, what if, another element of the period in the late 1890s showed up, and that would be an anarchist. This particular one happens to be from Russia. He's bringing a bomb, and he's telling them, you have to stay here, and I'm going to hold you hostage until you release these two political prisoners. So, sort of a dreadful circumstance, but, of course, in the meantime, he has to sit there in this room with these two women and their two leading men and one of the ingenues from the company, and the writer, Dumas, shows up. He would have actually passed away by the time this play was written, but the author, Gillian Grogue, couldn't help but bring in an author and a playwright in there to complain about the fact that actors never say the lines that are actually written or in the order in which they're written. One of the things I should maybe mention is that the reason for the camellias in the title is they don't have much smell, which is the reason why this particular consumptive woman would want to have camellias around her as opposed to, say, roses or something that would be more fragrant. Because they give her sort of an asthmatic attack. For some reason, when The Lady of the Camellias as a play got to America in translation, somebody got the idea that her name was Camille, which is a whoopsie-daisy in some sense anyway, because, of course, Camille is a man's name in France. And it has nothing really to do with her name at all. Her name was Marguerite Gautier, who was, apparently, had some historical significance in Dumas' life. He apparently knew a woman that he based this story on. Anyway, it should be a tremendous, great lot of fun, this thing. It's a great play.
When is the play going
to
be?
We're going to run it in November 1st to the 22nd. We might have a chance to take it up to Haynes in December.
Is it, or have all the actors been chosen?
Actors been chosen. We have scripts. We have a place
starting
to rehearse. We're all set. Yeah, Monday night we're going to begin our rehearsal. So.
And do you want to say something briefly about The Rivals?
I would love to. The Rivals was George Washington's favorite play. So here's Garrison Keillor talking about Checks and Balances, which we're talking about co-artistic directors. Between Keating and I, we keep each other checked and balanced. And we have, this is Mac. This is the sort of comedy that our these forebearers of ours would have watched and enjoyed this. The idea behind the rivals is that there's a number of gentlemen who are all want the same girl and all want to marry her, but she doesn't love any of them except the wrong one, of course, and she doesn't even know him by his real name. So.
And when is that play going to be?
That will be in March.
Okay, great. Well, it sounds like a really entertaining season. I'm speaking with Aaron Elmore about the upcoming season of Theater in the Rough. And if you want to find out more about the plays, your website is?
Website, theaterintherough.org, theater with an R-E.
Great. And thanks so much for coming in, Aaron.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Time for another toe-tapping, foot-stomping, dance-the-night-away time with the Hot Club of Cowtown. It's a Juno Jazz and Classics encore performance on Sunday evening, September 22nd at Centennial Hall. Get ready for an evening of hot jazz, western swing, and great dancing performed by one of the hottest trios ever. Jazzandclassics.org for tickets and more info for the Hot Club of Cowtown. Don't miss it. This message brought to you by Juno Jazz and Classics.
And this is Juno Afternoon, and you're listening to KTOO. And I have in the studio with me teachers Nancy Lenhart and Davin Sabico, and they're here to talk about the elementary art program. And welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for coming in. And go ahead and just describe this program, how it works.
Okay. I'm the elementary art specialist with the program, and we've modeled our program after the Fairbanks Elementary Art Program, which has been going on for like 30 years. And about 9-10 years ago, we started our program here. And the way it works is there's a team of art specialists that create lessons that are very they're very relevant for Juno students. They might relate to our local ecology. They might relate to our local native culture. And then we go in and we model these lessons for the teachers in their classrooms. So they watch us model the lesson. They get tips on talking to children about art and how to teach different techniques with paintbrushes and things like that. And then after we've modeled a lesson, we create a kit out of it. And we have a growing kit library, art kit library. And then the teachers then check those kits out in future years, and they teach the lessons on their own. So this program now is in its ninth year, and we've got about 200 art kits at this point, and teachers are really doing a lot of art. They really embrace the program, and that's why it's going so well and is so strong, is because teachers are doing the art lessons. So it's great.
So this is it's a different model of art classes like than when I went to school many, many years ago. It seems like it's more about art education as opposed to just like digging down and trying to find some talent inside me.
Yeah, we're basing all of our lessons on an art curriculum where, you know, we believe that art is very teachable and every child can learn things about color and line and texture. They can learn techniques with drawing and perspective and printmaking. And so, the lessons are very varied and the kids get really broad experiences. And I think every child is successful.
And what grade levels does it cover?
It's all our elementary grades, so K through 5 in every school. Each Juno school has access to the program.
How many kits are available to the teachers?
It varies by grade level. It's about 200 total. And, Davin, you're a kindergarten teacher. Do you kind of remember offhand about how many kits
are
available to you?
I can take a guess. I think we... At the kindergarten level, there's probably about 10, 12 kits. There could even be more than that. They show up about once a week, so that's all I'm really worried about. But the nice thing is if you teach if you teach, like, say you teach first grade, you can use the first grade kits, and you can actually go down to the kindergarten kits, too, if you found one.
So how many kits are checked out in a school year?
We're at over 1,000 at this point.
Wow.
So with every classroom teacher, I would say about 80% of our classroom teachers are using the kits very regularly, meaning they get a kit a week like Davin does, or a kit every other week maybe. And so about 30 to 40 kits are going in and out of the Art Center every week, and I do the check-in and check-back out again. And you just add that up over the weeks of the school year, and it's over 1,000 art lessons that are happening at this point.
Yeah, I think we checked out around 200 at my school last year, so...
So what's the feedback from the teachers about this? How do they like that?
Yeah, I think it's the best thing the district has going, like, period. It's just fantastic. Every time I'm doing an art kit, I just wish, I'm like, oh, yeah, I hope the principal walks in. I hope some big wig comes in our classroom. I just want to yank people in just to see just how amazing it is, how engaged the kids are. How much fun they're having, or how focused they are. And I know that we just love them as teachers. Yeah, you get a bag, and you have everything you need in this bag to teach like a wonderful, appropriate lesson. So,
sounds great, and it gets integrated with other subjects as well. And does this follow a art curriculum that's been developed for the school?
Yeah. We have an art curriculum in Juneau that builds from year to year, and so the lessons are based on those concepts and those skills for that particular grade level.
Great. So I've been talking with teachers Nancy Leonard and Davin Savico about the elementary art program, and thank you so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That's it for today's Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining me, and thanks to all the guests today. To listen to any of today's interviews or other Juno Afternoon programs, visit the KTOO.org website under Local Programs and Juno Afternoon. Please join us tomorrow at 3 for Juno Afternoon. Our host will be Lisa Fu. We'll find out about this weekend's 50th anniversary celebrations for the Glacier Valley Baptist Church. Joe Wolfenstein will be here to highlight this Saturday's Wild West Party. We'll get a preview of tomorrow night's Juno World Affairs Council meeting with guest Dr. Steve Faves, speaking on 6 continents on 1 bicycle, and Ruth Olson will give us an update on the activities at the UAS Student Rec Center. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, tomorrow at 3 on KTOO-FM. The weather today is showers, highs around 55. Tonight, showers likely, lows around 47. Wednesday, cloudy, scattered showers, highs around 56. You are listening to KTOO Juno. The Wednesday hike for September 18th starts at the West Glacier Trail. We'll meet at 9:30 a.m. This is a moderate hike. Bring trekking poles and plenty of food and water. Meet at the trailhead at the end of the road past Skater's Cabin at 9:30 a.m. No dogs or firearms, please. Have a great hike. Next up, All Things Considered.
Understands the concerns raised by these disclosures, and we're working with the Brazilians on this matter, and we'll continue to do that.
That from the White House after Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff postpones her state visit to the U.S.
For Tuesday, September 17th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Audie Cornish in Washington.
And I'm Melissa Block, reporting from Brazil this week. Coming up, revelations of NSA spying lead to a diplomatic rift with the U.S. and the postponement of President Rousseff's state visit. That story, and we'll take a helicopter ride along Brazil's northeast coast, where industry is booming.
These people used to be in the countryside of Brazil, and now they have moved to the big cities, next to where the money is now.
Also this hour, the second anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
And new music from British songwriter Tom O'Dell.
Now the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Law enforcement officials say shooting suspect Aaron Alexis entered the Washington Navy Yard lawfully yesterday before he began shooting his shooting rampage that left 13 people dead. NPR's Laura Sullivan reports.
Top law enforcement officials say Aaron Alexis entered the Navy Yard with a valid ID that he acquired from his work as a defense contractor. He was able to enter the gate with a shotgun. Valerie Parlave with the FBI's Washington field office said Alexis bought the shotgun legally from a store in Virginia. She said investigators are examining whether Alexis may have picked up a handgun on the scene, perhaps from one of his victims. Officials say he came to the D.C. area on August 25th and stayed in local hotels. Police Chief Kathy Lanier said officers were on the scene within minutes and entered the building about 5 minutes later. She said her officers and others exchanged gunfire with Alexis multiple times before killing him. Laura Sullivan, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, today there were both civil and religious ceremonies in Washington to remember the victims of yesterday's shooting. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports names of all 12 of those killed have now been released.
They include a father of 5, grandfather of 9, who was installing office furniture at the Navy Yard, an avid pilot who was building his own light airplane, an IT employee who, a colleague says, had a great spirit you could connect with. D.C.'s Cardinal Donald Wuerl led a mass downtown to mourn those killed. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel laid a wreath at the Navy Memorial. In the window of a building across from the shooting site, sheets of paper are taped up to spell Navy Strong. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he still doesn't have enough votes to pass a bill expanding background checks for gun buyers, even after yesterday's Navy Yard shootings. As NPR's Elsa Chang reports, Reid said he would consider bringing a more narrow proposal to the floor.
One day after a gunman killed 12 people at Washington's Navy Yard, it doesn't appear there's any greater support in the Senate for a bill to widen background checks for gun purchases. The proposal failed in the Senate in April, and Majority Leader Harry Reid says he still wants to bring it back to the floor.
We're going to move this up as quickly as we can, but we've got to have the votes first. We don't have the votes.
Reid said he'd also support a narrower proposal to improve mental health services in communities. Meanwhile, Democrat Chris Murphy of Connecticut says Congress must stop avoiding its responsibilities.
People are furious with this place, and they're going to be even angrier if after yesterday we continue to do nothing.
Elsa Chang, NPR News, The Capitol.
Positive day on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 34 points to close at 15,529. NASDAQ up 27 at